pull up a chair. I want to take you back to a cold gray morning in June of 1919. The place is Newfoundland, a muddy hilltop pasture they'd cleared of stumps and boulders by hand, because there was no such thing as an airport out there. Just a field and a wind coming off the North Atlantic that cuts straight through wool and leather like it wasn't even there. And sitting in that field is a great big biplane bomber that never dropped a bomb. Twin engines. Fabric wings the length of a country barn, loaded so heavy with fuel it could barely stagger off the ground. Two men are going to climb into that airplane and try to fly it across an ocean nobody had ever crossed nonstop. No radio worth the name, no heater, an open cockpit, and about 1,900 miles of black water between them and Ireland. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and today on The Hangar we're going to talk about John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown and the flight that everybody forgot because a fellow named Lindbergh came along 8 years later and got all the postcards, but these two did it first, and I'll tell you what they pulled off that night makes a lot of what came after look downright comfortable. Now before we get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, there ought to be a coin for what these two boys did. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. Back when AVGAS was cheap and airspace was free, and honestly, before there was much of either one, a British newspaperman named Lord Northcliffe put up a prize. £10,000, a fortune in those days. He'd first offered it back in 1913 to the first aviators to fly across the Atlantic in under 72 continuous hours. Then the whole world went to war, and the prize just sat there, waiting. By the spring of 1919, the guns had gone quiet, and suddenly there was a whole generation of young men who knew how to fly. Combat pilots. Men who'd spent 4 years learning the machine in the worst possible classroom. And there were airplanes. Big ones. Bombers built to carry a warload all the way to Germany. Now sitting idle with nothing to do. So the race was on, half a dozen teams shipped their machines out to Newfoundland, because that's the closest North America gets to Europe, and it turned into a genuine circus, crated airplanes coming off the boats. Crews arguing over the two or three decent fields on the whole island. One team would grab the good pasture, and the next crew would have to go find their own hillside and clear it themselves. Into this mess comes our two men, John Alcock, the pilot, a stocky, cheerful Englishman from Manchester, with a round face and an easy grin. He'd flown bombers in the war, been shot down over Turkey, spent the better part of a year as a prisoner. The kind of man who was never happier than with his hands on a set of controls and an engine roaring out front. Fearless in that quiet way, not reckless. Just genuinely unbothered by things that would keep the rest of us up at night. And Arthur Witten Brown, the navigator. Now here's an interesting fellow American-born, raised in Britain. He'd been shot down too, in France, and came out of it with a bad leg that left him with a limp for the rest of his life. While he was recovering, and while he was a prisoner, he taught himself aerial navigation. The real article, sextant, chronometer. The mathematics of finding your way over featureless ocean by the sun and the stars. The two of them had never even met before that spring. Brown came looking for work at the Vickers Company. Alcock needed a navigator. They shook hands, and inside of a few weeks they were partners in the most dangerous thing either one of them had ever attempted. Their machine was a Vickers Vimy. A big twin-engine biplane bomber, named for the battle at Vimy Ridge. Two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, and let me tell you, those Eagles were the reason any of this was possible. Beautifully made, as reliable as anything flying in 1919, which admittedly is a low bar, but they were the best in the world. The Vickers crew stripped the airplane of everything military and filled every space they could find with fuel. 865 gallons of it. So much petrol that the airplane weighed nearly 13,000 pounds sitting there, fully loaded, on a rough uphill pasture in thin, gusty air. Now here's where it gets interesting. They spent days just trying to get that field ready, filling holes, rolling out a strip, waiting on weather, and the weather out there. In June is a cruel joke. Fog, rain, wind that would swing 30 degrees while you watch the windsock. Finally, on the afternoon of June the 14th, 1919, the wind came around and the sky cleared just enough. Alcock made the call. We go. They climbed in. Two men in a wooden and fabric airplane, dressed in heavy flying suits lined with fur, electrically heated suits underneath that ran off a little wind-driven generator, because they knew what was coming up there in the cold. Brown had his charts, his sextant, his drift indicator, a little baby Nomad wind gauge. And, this is true, they carried two stuffed toy cats for luck named Lucky Jim and Twinkle Toes. Every crew has its superstitions. The Eagles came up to full song. Alcock let off the brakes, and that airplane did not want to fly. It rumbled down that rough field, bouncing and lurching. So heavy it seemed like it would never come unstuck. Witnesses said it staggered into the air right at the boundary, cleared a fence and a stand of trees by a margin you could measure in feet, and clawed its way up over the cold Atlantic with both eagles screaming. They were off. 4:28 in the afternoon, local time, and almost immediately the trouble started. First thing, that little wind-driven generator, the one powering their heated suits and their radio, sheared its propeller off, just like that. Now they had no radio, no electric heat, and they were flying into a North Atlantic night in an open cockpit at altitude, where the cold isn't an inconvenience. It's a killer. Then the weather closed in. This is the part I want you to really sit with, because there's a lesson in it that's as true in your Cessna today as it was in that Vimy. They flew into fog, then cloud. Thick layered endless cloud, with no horizon anywhere, just gray pressing in on all sides, now in 1919. The science of flying blind was barely born. They had a few crude instruments, a compass, an airspeed indicator, a primitive artificial horizon, and a turn indicator that were about as trustworthy as a rumor. Mostly, a pilot flew by the seat of his pants, by feel. And here's the thing. Every one of us learns, hopefully in training and not the hard way. Your seat of the pants lies to you in the clouds. Your inner ear will tell you you're straight and level while you're rolling into a spiral. It will swear to you that you're climbing while you're diving for the sea. And that is exactly what happened. Somewhere out over that black ocean in the cloud at night, the Vimy stalled. And it fell off into a spiral dive, Alcock flying blind with instruments he couldn't fully trust and an inner ear feeding him lies, lost control of the airplane completely. They came screaming down out of the overcast, engines howling, the airspeed building, the whole machine on the edge of coming apart, and they broke out of the bottom of the clouds so low over the Atlantic that Brown said afterward he could see the white caps and hear the sea over the roar of the engines. Some accounts say they were within 100 feet of the water, upside down or nearly so, with the salt spray practically in their faces. Alcock caught it, rolled it level, firewalled those eagles and hauled that big bomber back up away from the waves at the last possible instant. Think about that for a second. No autopilot, no flight director, no radar altimeter chirping at him. Just a man's hands and his nerve and the grace of two Rolls-Royce engines that kept running when he needed them most. If either one of those eagles had so much as coughed in that dive, we would not be telling this story. That was the first time the sea nearly had them. It was not the last. The night wore on, and the temperature dropped, and the weather got worse, not better. They climbed to get on top, looking for the stars so Brown could get a fix with his sextant. Every time a gap opened in the clouds, Brown would shoot the sun going down, or a star, or the moon, and scratch out his calculations by the light of a little pocket torch, his charts flapping in the slipstream, his fingers going numb. That navigation, by the way, turned out to be just about perfect. Understand what he was doing. Finding two moving points on a spinning globe, from a bucking open cockpit, in the dark, over an ocean with no landmarks, using the heavens themselves as his signposts. When they finally made landfall, Brown had brought them almost exactly where he intended. That is craftsmanship of the highest order, and it deserves to be remembered right alongside Alcock's flying. But the weather saved the worst for last. In the small hours they climbed into a bank of cloud that turned out to be full of ice. Rain first, freezing rain, and then snow and sleet. And ice began to build on the airplane. On the wings, on the struts, on the wires. Ice is death to an airplane. It ruins the shape of the wing. It adds weight. It can choke an engine. And here's the detail that I think tells you everything about the kind of men these were. The Vimy had an air intake and a little gauge out on the engine that iced over. And the story that came down, the one Brown himself told, is that he climbed out of the cockpit. Out. Into the slipstream. In the freezing night over the Atlantic with a bad leg and hung on to the struts and the wires and worked his way out onto the wing to chip and clear the ice away with his hands and a knife so the engine would keep breathing. And then climbed back in and did it again when it iced over once more. Now, historians argue about exactly how far out he got and how many times. And I'll be honest with you and tell you the tale has probably grown a little in the retelling the way good hangar stories do. But the bones of it are true. This crippled man left the relative safety of that cockpit, in the worst conditions imaginable, to keep the airplane alive. Because the alternative was the ocean, they flew all night like that, cold beyond describing, deafened by the engines. Soaked, fighting ice and cloud and their own exhaustion, passing a thermos and a few sandwiches back and forth. Two men alone above the biggest, emptiest, coldest stretch of water on Earth, with nothing between them and it but fabric, wood, and two faithful engines. And then in the gray light of morning, Brown looked ahead through a break in the murk. And there were two little islands, and beyond them, a green coastline. Ireland. They'd done it. They'd crossed the Atlantic, but they weren't down yet, and that green coast held one last insult. Alcott came in over the coast near a place called Clifton in County Galway, looking for somewhere to put her down. And he spotted what looked, from the air, like a lovely smooth green field. Perfect, inviting. It was a bog. A peat bog, soft as pudding. And what looked like solid meadow was in fact soaking wet marsh, right next to a wireless station. Alcock set the Vimy down gentle as he could, and the wheels touched and rolled and then dug in. The soft ground grabbed the landing gear and stopped it cold, and the nose pitched down into the muck. The airplane ended up sitting there in the bog with its tail in the air, and its nose buried, damaged but not destroyed. And the two men climbed out. Stiff. Frozen. Deaf. 16 hours and change since Newfoundland. 1,900 miles of open ocean behind them. The first human beings ever to fly across the Atlantic without stopping. The men from the wireless station came running across the bog, and one of them shouted, asking where they'd come from, and Alcock, in that cheerful Manchester way, just said, America. The fellow didn't believe him at first. Who would? They'd made the crossing in about 15 hours and 57 minutes of flying, roughly 16 hours from wheels up to wheels down. And Lord Northcliffe's 10,000-pound prize was theirs. A few weeks later, King George V knighted the both of them, Sir John Alcock and Sir Arthur Witten Brown, heroes of the Empire. Now, here's the part that always gets me, and I'll tell it to you straight because it's the truth of aviation and there's no getting around it. 6 months later, December of 1919, John Alcock, that fearless, grinning, unbotherable pilot who had crossed an ocean and cheated the sea twice in one night, was flying a new Vickers amphibian down to an air show in France. He ran into fog, low cloud over the French countryside, and he crashed, and he died. 37 years old. The man the Atlantic couldn't kill was taken by a foggy afternoon over Normandy in a routine flight. That's this business. It has never cared how brave you are or what you did last summer. It only cares what you do on this flight, right now. Arthur Brown was so shaken by losing his friend that he more or less never flew again as a pilot. He lived on for many years, quiet, a working engineer carrying that limp and those memories. He lost his own son, a pilot, in the next war. He passed in 1948. And their airplane? That mud-caked, bog-landed Vickers Vimy? They cleaned her up and she hangs today in the Science Museum in London. You can go stand under her wings, the same wings Brown crawled out on, the same fabric, more or less, that carried two men across the ocean when the whole world said it couldn't be done. So the next time somebody brings up the first flight across the Atlantic, and they say Lindbergh, and they'll always say Lindbergh, you nod. Because Lindbergh's flight was a magnificent thing, and he did it alone. But you lean in and you tell them about the two fellows who did it 8 years earlier, in an open cockpit, in a bomber, through ice and fog and a spiral dive that nearly put them in the sea, guided by a lame man with a sextant and a couple of stuffed cats for luck, Alcock and Brown, Newfoundland to a bog in Ireland. 16 hours that changed what an ocean meant. My thanks to the Science Museum in London, where the Vimy still hangs, and to the Royal Aeronautical Society's records for keeping the details of that night alive all these years. You can find us at RadioHangar.com if you want to sit in on more of these. That's the one for today. Fly it like Brown navigated it. Careful, and all the way to the far shore. I'm Tail Dragger. Blue side up.